James Moy, Leadership Development. This is our last session, and I wanted to share some personal note of appreciation for your attentiveness and for the real thrill and privilege that I have had in sharing my story with you. I know as I began telling all these stories and began thinking about what I would do the next day that so many of you also have your own stories, and it would be wonderful, wouldn't it, for each of us to be given a whole week's time like this, a whole block of 5 hours to tell our own personal stories. So in that sense, I feel very privileged and very special in being able to share this with you, and in many ways I want to thank God for this opportunity and to thank all of you for listening. I guess when I was walking over here with Margaret Wickstrom, we were talking about that, and she was sharing the opportunity she had once to share her own story with the diaconate group. And I think it's there's so much in our society today where because of our market economy orientation, we focus on what a person does and what they do for a living, and oftentimes miss out on the personal. So in that sense, for me, it's been quite a lot of fun to prepare that. I titled it Leadership Development primarily because of a number of significant events in my life that had led me to this field. And I think the announcement this morning was slightly off in trying to describe what it was that I was going to present. I hope to correct some of that. I guess some of those of you now who have heard my story these past 4 days, I don't think I ever saw myself as a leader. And in fact, most of what I did, I think, in the formative years were done to survive and to make it, and to try and sort of figure out this society, find my way through it as a Chinese American, balancing the values and cultural experiences from my family and that which I experienced in Chinatown with what I found in the larger world with the school systems and with graduate schools and with my jobs and with my calls in congregations and with all those job moves. And of course, throughout that whole process, all of us who work get evaluated. And a number of occasions when I began looking at the evaluation processes and systems that were used, there were things in my evaluation that were ambivalent and confusing and not accurate of me, and I wondered what's happening. And it took a while for me, for example, to come to the conclusion that I did have a certain leadership style, a certain way of doing things, and a certain preference. And it was almost by intuition, perhaps, but as I began reading literature of the past 10 years, I find out, oh, James, that's because you're Asian, you know. There are all kinds of books now that are printed on the Asian style of management, Japanese management, and so on. And I was completely oblivious to all of that, but I just found out that there were certain ways of reacting and behaving. And one notable experience I had, and Paul Nakamura will remember that, when I became president of the Asian Caucus in the LCA. It was a lot of fun, and I remember working with the whole group of Korean, Japanese, Chinese pastors from abroad, and realizing that that was a preferred mode. Most of the men, there was lots of discussion, but most of the men who were pastors there preferred operating from consensus. And I was very comfortable with that style and enjoyed it. Where did it all come from, I said, you know. And, well, it was interesting. Let me trace some of those threads on leadership development that sparked my interest. When I was at McAllister College, I had a number of opportunities to serve on various scholarship committees. And one of the most significant one was the Twin Cities Scholarship Program. Those of you from Minneapolis would be familiar with this, because we have about 8 private liberal arts colleges in the Twin Cities. And so every one of the colleges had scholarship programs to compete for the cream of the crop for students coming out of the public school systems in the Twin Cities. And so once a year, we would interview the whole crop of these top-notch students who might be top 10% of their class, who wanted a scholarship from McAllister College. And the college was fortunate in that it had a number of international programs. And there was a variety of them, so that one of the goals of the institution was to eventually graduate a senior class, all of whom will have had an international experience. That was the goal. And we on faculty and staff just drooled, because we wished they would include the faculty on that program. But we had programs where we sent students abroad to work as laborers in the Hilton Hotel chains at the foreign currency rate, so that they were not paid American wages. And it was a program that called for us, as the institution, to send the best ambassadors that we had. And so there were all kinds of interviews that were conducted for students who wanted to do that. They would go as a chambermaid to clean rooms in Amsterdam or in Rotterdam or in Brazil, Tokyo, all over the world, wherever there were hotels. And we sent about 175 such students around the world that way. The college was able to secure American Airlines flights for them, and most students chose to come home. If they went to Europe, they chose to come home through Tokyo. And if they went to Tokyo, they chose to come home through Europe and New York. So most of them have been around the world. And we have other programs where young scholars were sent to do research in the country of their choice related to social, economic, political problems in a particular country. And then we also had an Ambassadors for Friendship program where international students in the state of Minnesota were invited to McAllister to go on a summer tour to learn all they can about the United States. And our Ambassadors for Friendship would be the hosts. And we got American Motors to lend us their station wagon. And we got Chevron to give us credit cards for the students. And there are many, many homes in the country that hosted these groups. So essentially, the student took them on there was the Northwest tour, there was the Southwest tour, there was a Southeastern tour. And they would spend the whole summer doing that, visiting homes in the United States, staying in the homes of people who had learned about the program. And of course, again, we wanted the students who would best represent the college that way. So as a result of all these interviews and scholarships, I came to some observations as to what these students were like. And of course, at that time, I didn't see myself as a leader. I was staff, faculty, interviewing these kids. Most had already achieved something very significant in their lives by the time they were seniors in high school. They were Eagle Scouts. Some have published poems. Many were accomplished musicians. Some have I've been active community and church volunteers. Most had part-time jobs. Most had most were very articulate, and they all had a characteristics that were conducted were all high-stress interviews. These are not the kind of normal interviews people experience. Student would come to the committee. And they, you know that they're scared already. They're filled with anxiety. They come into the room, and we might say something like, well, what makes you think you're so special that you should be the recipient of this scholarship? Blows their mind, you know. And of course, we had to put stress because all of them were superb. These were all, I mean, there was no doubt that they were all, these were all leaders and all accomplished people. But we still nevertheless had to shift and make selections out of that crop. And we used a high stress interview. What we were looking for was their ability to deal with stress and strangers with aplomb. That they were not shaken, and that they had enough ego strength not to be threatened by a stupid question like that. Enough diplomacy to deal with that and still be able to come off, strong. That helped. That helped immensely at McAllister. I mentioned yesterday the Bush Leadership Fellowship that I was awarded. And they did the same thing to us. I remember I said, oh, look at this, these funds are available. So I applied for it and went through all these interviews. And we were invited to, I was a finalist. There were 25 of us from all over the state of Minnesota invited to the Ramada Hotel out in St. Paul, somewhere near 3M. And went through 3 days of all kinds of group work, impromptu speech making, testing, and interviews. And they used the same techniques on us, but by then, of course, I had the whole system figured out. Anyway, it was marvelous. I think the Bush Leadership Fellowship was the first one then that gave me a sense that perhaps there were other gifts that others had seen in me that I had not seen in myself, and that perhaps I should develop them. And although I wasn't sure exactly where I was going to develop them or how, but that the potential was there. I was about 29 years old then, 30 years old. And so with the fellowship, went on to Harvard. And J. Leslie Rollins, I mentioned yesterday, was the one who invited me to Ohio University, where he subsequently retired and built the farm there. I need to digress a little and say something about J. Leslie, because he was the financial aid officer at the Harvard Business School and dealt with all the special students that came to the campus with special monies from all these foundations that he had to negotiate with. And he was the consultant to the Bush Foundation in Minnesota. So he knew me when I arrived on the campus. He was one of the judges. And he has made a hobby of his life in not only identifying leadership potential, but in placing them in the business world. I think most public of all of his placement was Bill Agee and Mary Cunningham. And during that whole controversy with Aggie and Mary Cunningham, both persons had indicated that it was J. Leslie Rollins who brought them together with that company. When I read that, I kind of chuckled because that was the sort of thing J. Leslie did regularly. We also had occasion to conduct the funeral service for J. Leslie Rollins' first wife. And then a number of years on campus later, he ran across me in the street and says, could you marry me, Jim? He was marrying another faculty member whom he had met there. So we have some close ties with that gentleman. But it was he who began opening up the prospect of leadership development as a special topic, as a subject, as a program in higher education, and developed a number of them in various campuses across the country. I spent a lot of time at Ohio University working with the students in the Honors College. Here was another program similar to what we had at McAllister, where a special group of students were identified as having a special leadership potential and then given an opportunity to develop themselves with a personalized curriculum through the 4 years that they were there. And I had a number of opportunities to really ask a lot of hard questions, the fundamental one of which was, does it really make a difference? You asked the graduates and the students who went through the program, and the more important question was, can you take an average student, put them through the program, and make it work for them? And the most interesting thing that I learned from that whole experience was that it didn't matter, did not matter what we, faculty, administrators, educators, what we might say about a person's leadership potential, if there was anyone taking the average student off the street, if we would lay our hands on them and say, my son, you are a leader. It did miracles, just did wonderful things. Which is essentially what happened at the Honors College, and the undergraduates said that. They felt that the most special thing about the whole program was not the experience of the program itself, but that what the university was saying to them by picking them. And that, for me, was an enormous lesson. In fact, one of the most important lessons I got out of that whole experience is that I wish all of our pastors and leaders in the church would look at our young people as that kind of resource and say to each young person that you are special, that you are a leader, and that I'm going to expect a lot from you, and challenge them to no end. It works. The faculty said the same thing. Jim, I don't know, I'm teaching this course, they're called honor students here at the college, you know, but what's special about it? You could see the children grow, or you can see the students grow in self-confidence, grow in terms of special visions for themselves and what they might do and what contributions they can make in this society. Those were some of the most powerful learnings that I've experienced there. And in my new position beginning this September, it is my hope in training programs, training of clergy, as I seek to develop a network of partners in recruiting minority persons for ministry, either the ordained ministry or the associates, the lay program, the Associates in Ministry program of the church, that as we develop a network of such leaders in the church, whether they are Caucasians or minorities does not matter, because in my case, they were all Caucasian pastors that have shaped my life. I think the important ingredient is to identify this network and then to have them saying these kinds of things to young people whom they know, that the Lord has a special call for them and a special mission for them. And of course that would be professionally what my responsibility will be. However, I hope the pastors would also be broad-minded enough to see that if a person has special gifts as a banker or as a lawyer, that person would also be motivated in those directions as well. And I'm speaking as a guidance counselor now, as a whole. What else shaped me in terms of my interest in leadership development? When I was at Ohio University, we ran through all kinds of problems on campus during the war years with the Kent State shooting. And I was trying to struggle for a dissertation topic. And we, of course, had all kinds of management problems on the campuses. And there was a young professor named Ken Blanchard who consulted with the residence life staff and was helping us to solve dormitory problems and management problems on the campus. And he continually said to me, "Jim," he says, "you got to take some courses in my management class and not from the School of Education, because there are lots of things we can teach you, James." So I did. I enrolled in Ken Blanchard's courses, and he opened up a whole new world for me again in terms of management theory. And it was largely due to his influence then that he had shaped the selection of my dissertation topic. And I'm really proud to report this, because since those days, Ken Blanchard has become world famous. He and Paul Hershey, they're both faculty members that I knew, had written a number of textbooks, and when we were there, they began developing their situational leadership theories. And some of you in the bookstores might have seen his famous paperback called 1 Minute Manager. And he's written a bestseller. And when you write a bestseller like this, and when you are called to be a consultant in the business world, you quit the university. So Ken Blanchard is no longer at, he left Ohio University, went on to the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and he is now in private practice. He is a consultant now and has developed an enormous amount of materials related to situational leadership behavior. And I'm very happy to have shared in the development and testing out of many of the materials that he's worked with. And so I have a special interest now in pastoral leadership behaviors. Strong interest in this area. And perhaps for the next few minutes, I could engage all of you in some conversation, as I did the first couple of days in my dialogue here. I have great interest in that area. When I was assistant to Tom Blevins, that was one of my key interests in analyzing effective pastoral behaviors and ineffective pastoral behaviors, because I was eager to see if the theories that we've learned in human behavior was applicable in a congregational setting. And I need to say that they are. Very much so. So that's one of my interests. And I'd like to ask you all that question when you think through pastors whom you have had, and as you've observed pastors and church leaders in action, what you might find, what you think excellent, effective pastors should be like? That's one question. Number two, what kinds of pastoral leadership behaviors would you consider to be very desirable or not very desirable?
Should I leave? I have too many ex-parishioners here.
Okay, and one undesirable one?
Self-righteous.
Okay, thank you. How about the next group?
Inclusiveness, relating to all ages, situations in life, marital status, race.
marital situations. Okay. And one undesirable one?
Not modeling words about social concerns and habits. The words without the music.
Not modeling social concerns?
Right. That is preaching.
But not
modeling.
Not practicing what they preach?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Next group.
Positive, really caring about the members, being a shepherd to the sheep.
Caring of members. You say positive as well?
Well, being a shepherd to the members.
Okay, got it. And one from this side?
Inconsiderate of parishioners' time schedules. First service, second service start on time, but in between the Sunday school gets squeezed out.
Inconsiderate of parishioners' time schedule. An example is first and second service. The timing, huh?
Non-verbally, we're saying parish education is less important.
Okay. Next group.
We wanted a path to make good peppermint ice cream.
How shall I write it down here?
We did not prioritize here, so. But on the first one, if you wrote on your second, put language. See, number two, just write language, and then that would cover our...
Inclusive.
Oh, I see. Language.
With language, so. And then that would cover.
Okay.
The first.
And then on this side?
Well, I would use the word confidentiality, no gossip.
So on this side, you would say an undesirable behavior would be broken confidentials. Confidentiality.
Or use the word gossip first.
Okay. Okay, and any other group in between that one? This one then?
We got one here.
Okay.
We got so much. But I think probably one of the main things would be that we'd want a pastor who has strong spiritual leadership in that he would want to have Bible studies and prayer groups organized, but not necessarily that he'd have to be directly involved in all small Bible study.
For example, Bible study, prayer groups, etc. At least push for it.
Yes. We'd be really anxious to.
But not necessarily involved. Not necessarily personal involved in all of them.
Yeah, not having to be involved in it himself, but motivating to have it.
But motivating and supporting.
And organizing.
Okay, thank you. How about on this side?
It isn't desirable to have someone who is too controlling and is not able to listen and follow the suggestions of the parishioners.
Okay. Not too controlling and not listening. Okay.
And using the lay people.
Okay, this group here?
Yeah. For effective, I think it's a non-judgmental.
Okay.
And on the other side would be just judgmental.
Okay.
I have a question.
Sure.
What size parishes are these people coming out of?
Okay, I think you're raising a good question that I do want to spend a little time on at the end. I might as well state it now, because one of the major premises in defining effective or ineffective leadership
is the situation of variables that need to be taken into consideration. That's one of the major premises of Blanchard and Hershey, because you can have one leadership style for a while that's very effective, and maybe this is the situation that you are in and it's needed. However, the situation changes, and it takes people on the ball, leaders on the ball, who recognizes that the situation has changed, and therefore there necessarily need to be a change in style as well to make it consistent. That seemed to be a predominant pattern. So that if you, I found that the most ineffective pastors are the one who use one style for all situations. And throughout their whole career, their calls are all the same. I mean, their calls are all different in different congregations, but their behaviors are all the same consistently throughout all their congregations. And when you track them, you find that that story is to be true. They would say, oh, the pastor was just like that when he was here, or just like that when he was here, just like that when he was here. So the patterns don't change, and that seems to be a very important, significant variable. Does that answer your question, man? So that if you're in a university church, or if you're in a rural church, the behaviors are different.
Yes. Are there names for different styles of leadership?
I might spend a little time talking about that. Yes?
Well, we would like it if after if he has a little spare time, after he has done all that, if he could walk on water.
All these call committees always want someone who can do that. Now, this group up there, did you have something to share with us?
Well, I'm a pastor myself, so I refer to my mother.
Well, I feel that one thing that we zeroed in on was the pastor's own firm commitment to Christ.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And his vision of what he really wants to do. He should have his own vision.
Would that equate into a behavior?
Personal firm commitment to Christ. Can you say more about that in terms of behavior?
Well, we talked about his sharing his own spiritual journey with his congregation in a personal way. Not that he has already arrived and has a perfect faith, but we would like somebody who is firmly committed, but is also growing.
Okay.
Sharing that growth.
Okay, thank you. How about something from this column? Undesirable behaviors.
Well, I suppose the opposite of that would be someone who perhaps has gotten into the ministry by mistake. Really know what he was doing.
It's an easy job, you only work one day a week.
Is that what this group had? How about this group now? We'll come back to the first round. Do you have any other higher priority items there that you'd like to share that's not already up here?
A person who's able to demonstrate that he's well-grounded in the scriptures.
Okay. Demonstrate well-rounded knowledge of scripture. Okay. Anything that you want to add on this side?
Hidebound.
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 Could you tell us what you mean by that?
Absolutely sure that you're right about everything and not able to allow any other ideas to penetrate.
Know it all?
Yes.
Okay. All right. How about the next group?
We talked about developing
teaching and communicating well in everyday situations.
Okay. Communicating well in everyday situations. Okay. Anything for this column?
Pastor coming in untrained for conflict resolution.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. This group over here?
Of being a discoverer and enabler of hidden and or denied gifts among members. That's too long.
Yeah, not got it.
And then encouraging and trusting them.
Okay. Discoverer, enabler of hidden, denied gifts of members, and encouraging and developing. How about this column?
That's another story. Any sense of wanting to avoid any sense of superiority, pride, and pompous attitude. Maybe that's right.
Self-righteous, pompous attitude.
Okay, fine.
All right. That group back there?
Love people.
Okay. Love of people. Okay, and on this side?
Nothing new.
Nothing new. Okay. How about this group?
Being able to assess a congregation by what group is not being reached and being able to organize, facilitate how to reach that group or organize people to be able to do that.
No group composition or congregation, huh?
Yeah, good.
Anything on this side?
Not willing to reach out into the community.
Okay.
Doesn't know how to say hello.
Socially inept. What does this mean? Do you have any other comments?
You got sense of humor anywhere?
Sense of humor. I'll add that. Sense of humor. Okay. And it, something here?
The chip.
Chip on the shoulder?
Yeah.
Self-righteous. Okay. I think this list is helpful enough for me to learn. This is learning for me. Yes.
How about can't say no on the right side?
On the right side. Yeah. Cannot say no.
No sometimes family.
Is there any other item that's not on the board that you're just screaming to get onto the board? Yes?
I'd say willing to share that sometimes they're not affirming, sometimes they're not a shepherd, sometimes they are judgmental. So being, you know, a person who is struggling right along with the parishioners, that they are not all those things.
Willing to be vulnerable with the
struggling with and willing to be vulnerable.
Use the word integrity.
Oh, integrity. Okay.
How about the ability to delegate?
Delegate. I think I've got enough stuff up here.
I think, however, that we
delegate.
So
a lot
much.
Of synods are telling their councils to run the church, and the pastor is not allowed to delegate anything. The church council president does it now.
Okay, so some situations that doesn't work because it's already been delegated. Okay. Yes?
I think they need to be aware of what's going on in the world. I know Rudy has a saying that he thinks a pastor should have the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other.
Okay.
One other comment here.
So, nobody said good preaching, but I like to connect to preaching. He said it's not set for men. There's a lot of different styles, but it has to be some effective communication in Sunday morning.
Okay. Yes.
I think the pastor ought to be able to sing. I'm serious. I don't like the pastor standing up.
Okay, thank you. Let me have 3 more minutes for wrapping it up. There is a lot to say. There has been an enormous amount of material and literature in this whole field, and you asked the question whether there were different typologies and models of describing these various styles like that, and there are. Some of the most famous ones have been studies done at Ohio State, and and also at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and it's one kind of classical typology that was developed was by a Dr. Rensis Likert from the University of Michigan, and basically he set up 4 models of 4 systems, one being autocratic, authoritarian, and then 2 being authoritarian benevolent, and then 3 being participative democratic, and then the 4th model being consensus and consultative. And there's a continuum. And underneath each of those kinds of models, there's a whole series of activities that take place, such as communication systems. How do you communicate with your parishioners? How do you communicate with all the church members? Decision making. How do you make decisions in your congregation? How do you go about making decisions? That's a process that could take the shape of either an authoritarian autocratic style or a consultative consensus style. Interpersonal relationships, the kinds of friendships and the kinds of small group dynamics that occur in a congregation, the relational group. Kenneth Callahan talks about the relational groups that are established in the congregation. How do they behave within that system? Policies that you have, procedures in your church. As all of you know, there many of you have procedures and policies, some written and some unwritten. And the ones that are unwritten are the ones that are most confusing to your new members. They don't know how this place runs. It does not help them feel welcome. So there is a methodology for you to go through your policies and procedures, how you run the place, how you make decisions, the kinds of relational groups that you have living there, the communication systems that you employed in that congregation, and the way you make decisions. Goal setting activities in your congregation, whether it be done in an autocratic, authoritarian way, or the pastor says, this is what we're going to do, folks. We're going to have a new Christian education wing, whether anyone likes it or not, we're going to have it, you know. Or the consensus consultative style, and there's this whole continuum like that. And we would be fooling and deceiving ourselves if we were to think that one style is best, and so you can check off everything under one column. What will happen, what you will find often, is that as you go through each of those roles and items that I've talked about, the life in the congregation varies. But there is a dominant style, and that's what we want to look at in the congregation, in the life of the church.
Could there be a precedent set at an early time in the church life?
And that's what you call change, because some churches have 100-year traditions, you know. This has been chiseled in stone. We've always done it this way, Pastor. It's never going to change. So, So the pastor who comes in and who's interested in change then will have to deal with all the whole psychology of change and all the processes that are involved in organizational change. That's very difficult in churches. If you try to change the liturgical setting, that's very, very difficult in a Lutheran church. It's not easy.
Well, as you know, we're still working on some things, but I was wondering about in a staff situation, changes seem to be able to take place easier within the staff rather than getting out into the congregation.
Yes, right. Well, I found that these presentations have been wonderful. I'm glad you participated so eagerly this morning. In most of the workshops I do, I don't like to talk more than one third of the time and then leave two thirds up to the entire group. And I was hoping that would happen, and I thank you for your participation. I've enjoyed this week with you very much. There is much to be said. I will be getting a set of these cassettes from these presentations I've made, and I hope to have my secretary look at them and see if it makes any sense or not to type it up. Thank you very much.